I'm Bert Cohen. It's time for Portside. Where are we going to? Are we going back to the Republican Party? Is it time for them now? Everybody seems to have their moment in the sun. Politics is so much theater. You get climaxes and a lot of drama obviously involved, oftentimes a bit of comedy. But the question before us today in the first part of our show, Portside, is did the GOP get its groove back? And today, our guest is Washington correspondent for Salon.com, Mike Madden. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, has the GOP gotten its groove back? Are they set to take back America in the 2010 election, or are they fooling themselves?
Excuse me, you'll have to, I should say at the outset, pardon my cough. I went off to Texas and came back with bronchitis, so I hope it doesn't alarm too many listeners, but you know, the Republicans say they got their groove back. That was certainly the theme of this meeting. The gubernatorial arm of the Republican Party is doing better right now than the congressional one. You know, they just had big wins in Virginia and New Jersey, this was a sort of a chance for them to parade those victories in front of some donors and try to build some momentum going into next year.
And you're talking about the Republican Governors Association just had its meeting in Texas, a logical place for them. But so they had a lot of donors there as well. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's the sort of thing they bring in donors and activists and lobbyists and things like that. And most of the meetings were not open to the press. The ones that were sort of a lot of cheerleading and rah-rah, and my sense was that so were the ones that were closed to the press. A lot of talk about how they want to build on these victories next year and need help from their allies to do it.
Do you think that they genuinely believe that these victories, the gubernatorial victories in Virginia and New Jersey, were indeed a referendum on President Obama and were indeed a referendum on the Democratic Party in general? Do they really believe that? And do you believe that?
I don't know whether they I don't know whether they feel it was a referendum on the president. Haley Barbour, who's the governor of Mississippi, right, and is the chairman of the Republican Governors Association and is a fairly smart Republican operative. Barbour specifically said, you know, President Obama is still very popular personally. It's his policies that don't appear to be popular, in Barbour's conception. And what they set out to do in these last elections was basically run focused entirely on policy and on the issues that mattered in the states where they were running. So Bob McDonnell and Chris Christie, who were the new Republican governors-elect in Virginia and New Jersey, respectively, went out and talked about taxes and the economy in their states and didn't really get into, you know, a lot of back and forth over, gee, we need to beat back the White House agenda or anything like that. They just sort of focused pretty narrowly on economic issues. And I think, you know, that's sort of the model that the RGA is talking about using next year. You know, don't bother engaging with the president directly, but they want to build some momentum around what what they think is increasing alienation by independent voters over the specific policies that the administration is pushing.
So that Obama may be popular personally and his policies may not be. And I do wonder, as a partisan progressive myself, how much really that may be true. He's so much of American politics seems to have to do with celebrity, quite frankly. I mean, you got Sarah Palin out there. I don't think anybody's, well, I suppose a few people are taking her seriously as a potential political candidate, but mostly she's a celebrity. People want to see a celebrity. And I imagine the Republicans are figuring, well, okay, as they said during the campaign, that he may be the world's biggest celebrity, but his policies, he does tend to be, at least he's giving the image of being a little bit weaker than a lot of us Democrats would like. Do you think, are they connecting with people now, do you think? And what is Haley Barbour saying about connecting with the average people?
Well, you know, the Republicans certainly think they are connecting. Now, I think, you know, you could make the case on the flip side that both Virginia and New Jersey represented pretty difficult states for the Democrats to win this time around. You know, John Corzine was the incumbent governor in New Jersey, the Democrat. Incumbents are already unpopular given the political mood in the country. Corzine was kind of doubly unpopular since before he got into politics, he was involved in the top management at Goldman Sachs. New Jersey and Virginia both typically tend to vote for the party that's not in the White House in these odd year elections right after presidential elections. Creed Deeds, who is the candidate in Virginia for the Democrats, ran what, by all accounts, including many Democrats, was not the best campaign. You know, so certainly McDonnell and Christie connected well enough to win, but you could make the argument, and a lot of Democratic strategists are making the argument, that, you know, effectively it wasn't the best fight that the Democrats could have put up.
Well, it's true that, as you mentioned, those candidates there, the Democratic candidates for governor, just were not popular. So could they be, they meaning the Republicans, I wonder if they may be, frankly, delusional and just wishing it were so, but somehow thinking, well, maybe it's not so.
Well, I think, you know, it depends on what lesson that they take from these victories. If the lesson they take is essentially that Republicans can win if they run pragmatic campaigns where they talk about issues that are important to voters, then I think they're probably not being delusional. If the lesson that they take is Republicans are fated to win regardless,
right,
just because they're not the Democrats, then I think that is certainly not correct. you know, they have a lot of Republican governors who are incumbents themselves to defend next year, and those races may not be much easier for them than Corzine's was for him. Governors are sort of at the front lines of the clash between the economy and politics right now, because as they frequently like to point out, they have to balance their budgets in their own state, and they can't simply borrow more money like the federal government can. So when tax revenue falls and when you know, more money needs to be spent on social programs because citizens don't have the resources that they used to, then it's the states that have to deal with big budget shortfalls. And there's nothing that makes you unpopular quite like slashing the budget right before an election.
Well, yes, that certainly can be a difficult situation, or having to raise taxes. We're talking on Portside with Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com, who wrote an article on Salon.com about the GOP getting its groove back. You were lucky enough to be there in Texas. Where in Texas was the Republican Governors Association?
They met at a resort just outside of Austin. I and most of the reporters who were there stayed in Austin itself, which was nice.
Yes, we're here.
And the resort was about a 20-minute drive outside the city. It was a very big, sprawling complex with you know, golf courses and a shooting range and all sorts of stuff. So it was sort of a combination of vacation destination and a political cheerleading meeting for most of the people that were attending.
And that brings up to me the question of populism and the Tea Party people and it's fairly common knowledge that the Tea Party people are backed in large part by Dick Armey's corporate benefactors. And I wonder how openly the wonderful allegiance, familial allegiance there was evident at the Republican Governors Association meeting of the current Republican Party to certain corporate benefactors. Was it just wide open and, you know, not in any way hidden?
Oh, it was not remotely hidden. There were the sponsors' names were all over everything. And, you know, the lobbyists who attended were wearing name tags with their employers' names on them. I mean, they had a welcome barbecue on Wednesday night that was sponsored by, among other people, the Corrections Corporation of America, which is a major prison outsourcing management firm. That was clearly there to try to drum up business and get the governors to turn over their corrections facilities to them. And there was another party that was sponsored by some IT providers and a supply chain logistics company and a mining company and the liquor lobby. The lunches were all sponsored by big companies with business pending in most of the state capitals. It was not at all hidden. But I should say that, you know, this was clearly not the Tea Party crowd. I mean, this was very much the corporate, not remotely populist end of the GOP. Haley Barbara, I'm sure, would be happy to take votes from the Tea Party attendees, but I don't think he's particularly tight with that sort of, you know, to the extent there is actual grassroots populism involved. I don't think that's something that Haley connects with on a fundamental level.
Well, doesn't that, I would think that might present a very, very significant problem for the people, the interests at the Republican Governors Association, the Tea Party people, the split in the Republican Party. It does seem like, you know, perhaps you could take as a given that the Democratic Party may be weaker now than it was in 2008. There does seem to be that historic trend every you know, off year generally helps the party that's out of power. But then again, you have people like Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, which of course started the war over 100 years ago, fueling contentious primaries, pushing candidates who may be loved by the base, but is not loved by the Haley Barbers of the Republican Party, the establishment of the Republican Party. There must have been some talk about the concern about these out-of-control Tea Party people.
There wasn't a huge amount of talk about it, which is interesting because Texas actually is the site of what could turn into one of these contentious primaries, although in that case it's the incumbent governor, Rick Perry, who's a Republican, who is sort of pandering to the Tea Party crowd and trying to fend off a challenge from Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, who is seen as sort of more the country club Republican type. But in that case, Haley has come down pretty firmly on Perry's side. When you talk to kind of professional Republican operatives, there's a sense that they don't entirely know what they have with the Tea Party. They don't know to what extent they're going to actually show up and vote. They don't know how they might behave in elections. They recognize that there's a powerful force there, again, to the extent that there's something grassroots going on, which I think there is, independent of Army's efforts, although maybe not as, it may not be as broad-based as Freedom Works like to make it seem. But at any rate, you know, they don't quite understand how to harness it or whether they can harness it. And I think there's, you know, some excitement about the possibility that it could be helpful for them, but also some concern that they don't know how it's going to play out. And I think that, you know, what you see in Florida with Marco Rubio as the candidate of the base challenging Governor Charlie Crist for the nomination for the Senate is a good example of that dilemma where, you know, Crist is kind of seen by most people as probably the more electable candidate in the general election. He's fairly popular in Florida. He's a moderate. He, could stand a shot of getting a significant number of Democratic and independent votes. But Rubio is by far the preferred candidate among the Tea Party set, and DeMint is now backing him. So you know, I think the message out of this meeting was sort of that, gee, the Republicans have solved all their problems. But I think if you look a little bit deeper, and not a whole lot deeper, you can see that they still have some significant issues to work out ahead of next year.
We're talking with Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com on Portside. I'm Bert Cohen. So what problems do they feel like they solved? They've identified actual problems, and they feel like they've actually solved them. Does that mean there's a Republican brand now?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the governors would say basically that Republican governors in general prove that Republicans can get things done. There was a lot of talk differentiating Republicans in the states from Republicans in Washington. And the gist is basically, you know, voters are familiar with Republican governors. Some of them are popular back home. And they demonstrate that Republican ideas and conservative ideas can work when they're put in practice, as opposed to the Republicans in Congress who don't really have the power to do anything, kind of keep offering the same set of policy solutions to a lot of different issues that come up and never have a chance to put them into practice and implement them. So mm-hmm. you know, you have a contrast between, at the federal level, basically when voters think Republican policy, they still drift back to President Bush, versus at the state level, where there are some governors that are actually doing things and governing, and you know, for the most part, not running their states into the ground quite the way that voters seem to think they were doing at the federal level. So it's not so much that they laid out a list of issues and problems that they have and figured out ways to solve them. It's more that you know, they think that these sort of pragmatic economic-focused campaigns can work, and they think that some of what they've been doing on the state level can work.
The pragmatic, there must be. It would have been interesting to be there, I'm sure it was for you, to see that. It sounds like the more pragmatic end of the party was largely there, the people who want to win elections rather than be purist. And there's got to be some concern there. Perhaps you saw that the Tea Party people may win the primaries because they get that base out, that hardcore base out, but in the process alienate independents and then, you know, snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. There must be a lot of concern about that, you know, they want to use and talk nice to the Tea Party people, but still be, you know, at the service of their corporate benefactors and be something that doesn't scare people so much. Or maybe they don't think that the Tea Party people scare moderate and independent voters. What was your sense of that?
Well, you know, I think it sort of depends on who you ask. You know, some Republican establishment types seem genuinely excited by the Tea Party. You know, they don't entirely understand what's going on with them, but they think that it demonstrates that the intensity and the passion is more on their side than on the Democratic side. And if that's the case, that would be the first time since 2004 that it was. You know, last year and in 2006, Democrats were far more energized than Republicans were. And especially in an off-year election where there's not a presidential campaign going on, questions of who is more intense and who is more passionate can often determine the results of a number of races. I mean, if you look at Virginia and New Jersey, for instance, the turnout was basically half of what it was during the presidential election. So, you know, if people aren't going to show up to vote, then whoever's more energized is likely to win. And in a lot of cases, that does seem to be the Republicans right now. But at the same time, there's also, I think, some concern that the Tea Party people are more interested in ideological purity than they are in winning, and you know, that there's some frustration that the control of the party apparatus could be threatened in some of these cases. Now, obviously, the Tea Party folks would say that was just fine with them, and they're not really concerned with control of the party apparatus, but the establishment is very much concerned with that. So,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends on the state and on the specific race and on what the circumstances are. I mean, Jim DeMint is not particularly popular among Republicans in the Senate, and I don't suspect that this effort to launch primary challenges in a lot of Senate races is going to endear him more to his colleagues.
Well, I wonder about the Republican brand, if it's possible even to have a brand, because, you know, there may be certain parts of the currently United States that being hard right really pays off. But in other areas of the country, you want to present yourself to be more moderate. So I don't know if there can really be a brand, whereas, as you say, the governors have that unique ability to be of that state and just be a brand there. So there may be a real disconnect between the governors, who can be pragmatic and be exactly much more reflective of the area that they are. And I wonder if they're making really too small of a tent right now. You know, there's that all talk about the Democrats, well, used to be a big tent, and Indiana Congressman James Bopp drafted a resolution calling on the party to stop funding and endorsing any candidate for any office who deviates from three or more of the 10 planks that they have drawn up. And certainly Ronald Reagan deviated from these planks: smaller government, market-based health care reform, opposing cap and trade, supporting so-called right to work, anti-union stuff, victory in Iraq and Afghanistan, Defense of Marriage Act. This is stuff that's pretty far on the right there. And that's got to be presenting some problems for the Republicans, I would think. But then again, you were looking at the gubernatorial level, and did you come out of there thinking that there was a sense of unity?
Well, I don't think a lot of the governors are. I mean, if they're smart, I don't think a lot of the governors plan to run next year on, you know, issues like the Defense of Marriage Act. I think that the one lesson that the Republican Governors Association folks seem to have learned is that you really just don't want to get into any of that culture war stuff. It's not what is motivating voters right now. I mean, Bob McDonnell in Virginia is very conservative, the Deeds campaign tried unsuccessfully to point out. He wrote a thesis when he was in graduate school, basically arguing that, you know, women shouldn't be in the workplace and taking all sorts of extremely hard right, socially conservative positions. But McDonnell didn't really talk about it. I mean, he essentially brushed off that issue as irrelevant and stuck to talking about jobs and the economy. And so, you know, you can run candidates who are conservative on social issues, but
you don't want them front and center.
Out there to talk about that stuff. I think it has the tendency to remind independent voters why they have been voting Democratic the last few years.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering about the whole momentum. If health reform fails in the Senate, they must be counting on health care reform to fail in the Senate. I wonder if that could mean they must be sort of, I would think they'd be foaming at the mouth, ready to go on that, because that could indicate some weakness. You know, and again, it's theater on the Democrat part, and maybe just win by default. Was there any?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, your question about the Republican brand earlier, I think the brand the Republicans are hoping for next year is basically, we're not the Democrats. And I think they're hoping that voters, especially swing voters, are so alienated from the policies that the administration and the Democratic Congress is pushing that they just reach out for the alternative, even if they recall the alternative as being a pretty bad choice in recent years themselves. If healthcare fails, then the Republicans will certainly seize a lot of opportunity there, which is why I think, you know, you hear consistently from Democrats that the only thing they simply cannot afford to do is not pass something. Even if they wind up having to compromise even further on questions that progressives are very concerned about, I think the Democratic leadership would rather pass a bill that's seen on the left as being a little bit flawed than not pass anything. And it was sort of the main lesson from the 94 elections was that the only thing worse than passing a bill that voters don't love is talking about a bill that voters don't love and then failing to pass it. So, you know, if the White House has its way, we won't get to see what kind of momentum the Republicans can pick up from the failure of healthcare. But I guess that remains to be seen.
Oh, it certainly does. Well, just one final question. I know your health has seen better days, and I appreciate your being with us, Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. I'll start with the early question. does the GOP have its groove back?
I think there, as you may have noticed, there was a fair amount of irony that went into that headline. I think that when you get right down to it, it would be hard to say that the Republicans really have recovered entirely from the last several years and from the Bush administration. Democrats may have lost some of their own groove, but I'm not sure that it's entirely a zero-sum game. I guess it winds up being by election time, but, you know, voters can be dissatisfied with both parties, and when they're dissatisfied with both parties, it's not always easy to predict who they wind up settling on when it comes time to vote. They may just decide not to vote.
Wow, that certainly could be the case. My goodness, it will be interesting from here on out. We'll see if the Republicans can find their way back. Mike Madden, Washington columnist for Salon.com. Thanks for being with us on Portside today. And take care of your cold. I'm sure you will. Chicken soup. Thanks. Yeah, we'll see if the Republicans can find their way back. And we will see if the Republicans have found their way back. Bert Cohen here on Portside, and we're going to switch gears just a little bit. Still politics, of course, but one of the things that's taking up just about all the political oxygen for the last couple of months or so, and is going to continue to do so, somehow sneak in past the Christmas season, is healthcare reform. Everybody's talking about it, but there's a lot of questions, and one of the big questions is, what is this thing called the trigger? What is the trigger? How is it going to affect my insurance, my ability to buy health insurance? Our guest on this subject is Robert Creamer. Thanks for being with us, Robert. Are you there?
Right.
Well, let me tell you, the listeners, Creamer has been a political organizer and strategist for almost four decades. He and his firm, the Strategic Consulting Group, work with many of the country's most significant issue campaigns, and you guys have been working quite a bit on the healthcare front to try to have a public option. Some very effective ads, I must say. Creamer was one of the major architects and organizers of the successful campaign to defeat the privatization of Social Security. Thank you for that. He's also a consultant to the campaigns to end the war in Iraq, pass universal healthcare, change America's budget priorities, and enact comprehensive immigration reform. He's worked on hundreds of electoral campaigns at the local, state, and national level, and he's married to Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from Illinois. And Arianna Huffington calls his recent book Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win a Master's Class in Electoral Politics. Well, for those who have heard of the trigger but are really confused, what does it mean and what are its political implications for the next few weeks?
Well, the trigger provision has been set forward mostly by Senator Snowe as a means of addressing the desires for a public option without really creating one. Now, there are a lot of different ways to create it. I mean, if in the final analysis you could create a provision that triggered the creation of a public option or the opt-in of a public option for a particular state by some objective factor, that factor could be almost a hair trigger, depends on how it's defined. But as Snowe has talked about it, it's a kind of a vague affordability standard, which would probably never be met. Here are kind of the iterations of this whole conversation. There's a proposal for the public option. That's one that passed the House. There's a proposal for a public option with an opt-out, allowing states to opt out, which, at least in our view, is not such a bad thing because we don't frankly expect, once things get cooking, anybody's going to opt out. Same way they all said, oh, well, we're not going to take the stimulus money, and all did. There are proposals for opt-in, which are obviously not as good as an opt-out. And there's finally this trigger thing, which is the opt-in and opt-out are about human action, that is, the state legislature has to decide or whatever. The trigger provision is some objective criteria has to be crossed. In the final analysis, I mean, all these things may be in the mix in the Senate. In the politics, we'll really get down to how tough the House members and Senate members who are on the progressive team will be at demanding a real public option in the final settlement.
So is this, as you say, Olympia Snowe from Maine is really pushing it. What is her, why is she doing that? Is it some political cover? Is she covering the backside of the insurance industry? What is her motivation? Why is she doing this? Is it just to be known across the country?
Well, clearly it's not a purely political motivation, since the public option is one of the most powerful, popular elements of the healthcare reform legislation in virtually every state. I mean, even states where the generic concept of healthcare reform is not as popular, the choice of a public option is popular. So it's not that. She's one of the few Republicans that even toyed with voting for the measure. Most of the Republican Party is entirely a subcontractor for America's insurance industry, who absolutely is opposed to any public option because it will cut into their action. I mean, it'll cut into that percentage of the overall health care expenditures in the United States that they don't get to skim something off of. That's the fundamental issue. And it will also, of course, drive down prices through competition. It'll because there's no profit margin, no high administrative costs, no huge CEO salaries that are paid for the people who run a public option the same way they are for Medicare. You know, one other option, by the way, that's kind of on the table that is interesting, and I think from a progressive point of view would be the thing we'd all want in the first place, is just to allow people to buy into Medicare. It's already there. No reason in the world that someone who's been paying into Medicare shouldn't be able to buy into it as their insurance plan before they get to be 62 or 65. And there are some strange members of the Senate who express some interest in that. So who knows? That may end up being out there on the table in the end of this process as well.
We are talking with Robert Creamer about health care reform, health insurance reform, and in particular, the trigger, whatever the trigger is. And so if Snowe comes along, does that, there's so many, as somebody described it, trying to get enough votes in the Senate is like trying to load frogs into a wheelbarrow. You put one in, a couple others jump out. And I just wonder, and if the trigger aspect of it would make it so that it would pass enough and be good enough for people who want the public option. I mean, you know, and I know, we see people on the media somehow, because the media just loves theater, the visual media, and people saying, oh, we don't want government takeover. You know, there's that expressed opposition to really the public option. And certainly the insurance companies must really like that. So I wonder if this would be beneficial to the insurance companies. And I just might add that clearly Joe Lieberman represents the state of insurance. I mean, that's where they...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, the trigger, all of these attempts to weaken the public option are done in behalf of the insurance companies. I mean, there's no rational argument to be made as to why consumers should not have a choice of a public option. If it's a choice, then if they don't like it, if it's not good, if it's not priced well, then presumably they wouldn't choose it. The question is, do we let consumers choose? And that's why it's so popular. It's popular every place. So they have a hard time arguing against giving people a choice of a public option on its merits. I mean, they go to these, oh, fear of government takeover,
right,
which does not sell very well, by the way, or to the fear that one day, if you let there be a public option, they'll outcompete everybody in the private marketplace.
Right.
Well, if they do, then that would be fine too, frankly, from my point of view, because you know, that means that the private marketplace, that's so, you know, these guys talk about how they should be able to, always the private market does better. If the private sector can do better, why are they afraid to compete?
That's right. I certainly couldn't agree more. And the insurance industry is in the business of insuring their profits. That's what they're there for. But so, again, on the trigger, just to define it, tell me if I get this right. The idea is to give the insurance companies a set period, which we don't know what that would be, to make changes that would bring down long-term costs and help cover more people. And then, so if the industry doesn't meet the goal of covering more people and bringing down costs, then it would trigger the public insurance option. And this way, the idea is to put pressure on the companies to make those changes. But you know, and I know, they're not going to make those changes. I can't imagine that they would, the insurance companies. I mean, every chance they get, they raise rates on their premiums. So,
I mean, this is all about delay and weakening. As you go through this process the next 2 months, and this is, I think, a potentially historic time. I mean, we have the potential,
yes,
of really passing fundamental change in the healthcare area and making healthcare right in America. But we have to, the principal thing I think we have to look at is the architecture of what is created. If we need to make sure there is a public option that is set up at the federal level, even if various states can opt in or out of them,
right,
we need that set up, and it needs to be set up in advance. Some of these trigger proposals have said, well, we'll trigger it on a state-by-state level when it happens, and then, of course, you'd have to spool it up and start it up after the trigger happens. Well, that's ridiculous, right? That's all just aimed at placating people who want a public option, putting it off into the unforeseeable future.
Right.
We need to create that public option apparatus.
You and I tend to agree.
If that is done, we can tinker with it. That's the thing we got to keep our eye on the ball with.
We are talking on Portside with Robert Creamer, political organizer and strategist, worked on a number of different issues, including the current healthcare reform debate. So what happens to the average working person if what comes out of the Senate and the conference committee has a so-called trigger option? Does that mean their rates don't go down, health insurance is no more accessible? Would it be the case that by the 2012 election, nobody'd see any difference?
No, you know, there are a number of things that would pass in this bill that go into effect immediately. I mean, a variety of consumer protections go into effect right away, and they are very important. That is, out of the House version or frankly, out of Harry Reid's Senate version. But many of the more fundamental aspects, the creation of the exchange through which farmers and small business people and people who don't have access to insurance through their employer could buy insurance, those don't go into effect until, in the House version, 2013, and now in the current Senate version, until 2014. And we've got to, and I think there'll be some move to move those things up. because people obviously need the benefit now. That's all the more reason why the notion of a trigger is so ridiculous. I mean, putting things off into the unforeseeable future don't help do what we need to have done now, which is to provide consumers options and provide competition in the marketplace that brings down costs through competitive pressure. And they always talk about competitive pressure. Now's the time for them to put up or shut up. Do they want a public option that we know will produce a competitive pressure in these marketplaces? Remember, 94% of the marketplaces in the United States, the insurance marketplaces, are considered to be uncompetitive right. by the study done by the AMA. I mean, that means just a few players from which to choose. And that's why one of the major causes of increases in these costs. You know, insurance industry profits have kept going up even while demand for health care insurance has dropped during the recession. That is not the sign of a competitive marketplace.
That's for sure. And talk about competition. When I served in the New Hampshire State Senate, the insurance industry brought in legislation to, on the outset, you know, on the appearance, to create competition. But what it did was enable cherry picking, so that insurance companies could pick and choose healthier workers, younger people, redline certain parts of the state that would have to pay more. That's the kind of competition that the insurance industry tries to get. And it's interesting to me how much power they have. Is there any other, I mean, you, Bob, and I might agree that, you know, nothing but a public option makes sense, that it may not be worth very much if it doesn't have a public option, but there's a very big political struggle going on under the dome of the Capitol right now. Is it just really the power of the insurance industry? Is it that obscene?
Well, it's not just the insurance industry.
Okay.
Everyone who has a stake in preventing the success of this presidency, everyone who has a stake in preventing the onset of a progressive era that really changes the relations of power in the United States, understands this is the symbolically most important issue that will either uncork change or stop it dead in its tracks.
Mm.
If this president loses health care reform, it will be very difficult to pass regulatory reform of the financial sector, to pass clean energy legislation, to pass immigration reform, to do any of the other things on the agenda, to create jobs will be more and more difficult. If we win, and this is like, and I had a piece the other day in the Huffington Post that, so this is like on the long march since Barack Obama declared, it's like we have arrived at the gates of the castle of the status quo.
Yeah.
And our job is to breach the gates here now. And that's what this battle for healthcare in that last 2 months is. Once that happens, into the breach will flow lots of fundamental change. If it doesn't happen, that will not be the case. So the Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
Lots of business, big business entities, the right wing, the talk show, they will gang up. They will bite and claw and poke eyes and do whatever they can to stop this from passing in the next 2 months.
We are talking with Robert Creamer about healthcare reform, and your image of storming the gates is a good one. And I have to believe the people, as you say, inside the gates know this and want to make sure that they stop it. And then on the other side, there are people like Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and others who feel like, hey, if there's no public option, forget it. It's no good. I'm not going to vote for it because it doesn't make any difference. What would you say to them?
I think it's important for Bernie Sanders, for my wife, for the progressives in the House, for Sherrod Brown, for Rockefeller, I mean, for a number of these people who are strongly for the public option, to make it clear that there must be some form of public option in this bill or there won't be the votes for passage.
Do you
think? Because that's the only leverage they have in the end. And I believe that the people who are on the other side of this, that is, the people who are standing away, I mean, people like Ben Nelson, people like Lincoln and Landrieu, right, will ultimately agree to something, because I don't believe they will want to be, go down in history as the people who stopped health care reform. And I also think, frankly, that would be a politically disastrous move for them. I mean, somebody like Lance Lincoln is up for re-election. It may not be as popular in Arkansas as it is in other states, health care reform.
Right.
But the base of the party that she needs to turn out will be infuriated by her if she stops health care reform.
So that is always one thing that both Democrats and Republicans have to worry about, is primaries, being challenged in a primary by people who feel more pure on issue than one another. So you're suggesting that people like Blanche Lincoln and others from basically red states should go for the public option, and it would serve them better politically, electorally, to do that.
Even... I think so. I mean, they're worried. I'll tell you what they're worried about. I mean, they're worried about the influx of large numbers of forces from all over America descending on them to make them an example. And our answer to that needs to be not just we want you to do it, but if you vote right, we will have your back. We will be there with our forces and our money and our organizations to defend you. Because it ain't enough just to say, oh, go do it and you're right. It's enough to say this is a political battle and we will be there for you if you vote with us.
Well, that didn't.
And we have to say that credibly every place.
The Obama team, the people who were so filled with hope, you know, that whole phenomenon wasn't there in Virginia and New Jersey for the governor's races there. So why should people like Blanche Lincoln and others expect them to be there for her?
Well, that's true. You know, the problem we had, of course, in New Jersey and Virginia.
Yeah, they are different animals, really. Yeah.
There was a turnout issue, and part of that was because. But you know, in the end, here's the other thing about electoral politics, right? People vote for people, and neither, of course, I nor Green Deeds were particularly popular,
right?
In their states, and that's an independent variable you've got to really deal with. That has nothing to do with the issues. That has to do with the people.
So could we, if it comes out of the Senate, is a trigger? Would progressives, people who are deeply, deeply dedicated to the public option, could they declare victory?
I think if it comes out of the Senate with a trigger, then the House will go into negotiations for a full public option.
That's true, because they wanted one, yeah.
Something in between will come out. Now, in many respects, I think Harry Reid has created that something already with an opt-out. And it is my hope that we'll see that opt-out provision, that public option with a state opt-out, come out of the Senate. I think there's decent odds we can get there.
So
it really depends on our ability to convince Lieberman, Lincoln, Nelson, and Landrieu that it's in their politically best interest to vote for it. To allow the bill to go to the floor. They don't have to vote for the bill in the end. That just requires 50 votes. They have to vote to allow an up or down vote in the Senate on this bill.
I had forgotten that just requires 50 votes to pass. That's right. That's right. And Klobuchar.
The other thing to remember is it will be very hard to amend this bill on the floor without the agreement of the majority leader. I mean, every amendment will require 60 votes as a practical matter. And you're not going to get 60 votes to strip out the public option. So the odds are good that unless there is some compromise offered by our side, that this bill will come out with, at least that's what will go to a final vote. And then the question will be whether those members will vote for it or not.
Right.
And there'll be two opportunities or two requirements. One is they'll have to vote for it to get out of the Senate. And then, of course, on both sides, they'll have to vote for it out of the conference. So even if a trigger were to come out of that Senate, there's going to be one more opportunity to get a tougher, real-life public option on the conference report.
Again, Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with Robert Creamer, political strategist, talking about the trigger option and what is going on in the Senate with the health reform debate. Now, supposing the trigger is in there, what do you think? Will it pick up Snow? Will it pick up any other Republicans? Will it make them feel more comfortable?
Enough? I think the only potential Republican is likely to be Snow, that is gettable on any terms. And it is true that to get her, I think you'd probably have to have some kind of trigger provision. And as I say, I mean, trigger provisions are not all alike. I mean, you know, if you created a public option entity to start with, and there were some very doable trigger at the very front end that happened right away, well, you know, that might be a possibility, although, I say that may be a possibility, that might be a possibility that's not entirely a disaster. As it was drawn before the Senate Finance Committee, it was useless. It was a trigger for affordability that would never be met, and so it was nothing. So you have to look at the consequences of whatever proposal in very in its real substance. And as I said, I think the central thing we want to look at throughout this process, there must be the architecture of a public option in place, however the opt-in or whatever of various states are considered, after this process, or we will not have done what we need to do to deal with the health care issue in the United States.
So then a trigger option might not be so bad if there is a public option in place, a mechanism in place, and it's a very specific trigger that's not doesn't go out too far. You know, you wouldn't want it if they... A trigger could be that, say, if the industry doesn't meet the goal in 10, 15 years, then there's a trigger. Then it's, you know, already gone. So it has to be a reasonable... Well, go ahead.
You know, I think, I got to tell you, I don't believe that that will be what we need to do. I believe that what will come out of this bill or this process will be a public option that is real and will ultimately have substantial coverage throughout most of the United States.
Hmm.
I mean, I think we should stick to our guns to demand that, because that's what is required to create a change in the power structure of the healthcare industry. That's what's required to actually put us on the road to controlling healthcare prices. That's what will put us on the road to providing people options and choices.
It's interesting to me. It seems like many people in Washington must not really be aware of the sentiment, the widespread sentiment with regard to the insurance industry that there is out there. You know, there's the people, the average citizen who feels like, hey, wait a minute, what's the insurance industry doing? I'm paying way too much. On the other side, they have a lot of money. They pay lobbyists really well, and they certainly contribute to candidates, Democrat and Republican. And they must be, the insurance industry must be a little bit scared about that. But do the powers that be in Congress just really underestimate, or I suppose Bush would say misunderestimate, the feelings that the public has for the image, at least, of the insurance companies being so greedy and denying health care to needy people? Do they not get that?
It's easy to be insulated in Congress from what people really think about these kind of things, because there are, as you say, there are six insurance industry lobbyists for each member of Congress. and they spend a lot of time pressing their point of view. But on the other hand, and the other thing is, if we're not talking about the insurance industry and making this real clear that it's basically the insurance industry or the consumers, those are the choices people have. If we're not constantly putting in that frame, then they win. So it's very important for us to, throughout the balance of this debate, make it very clear this is about the insurance industry or normal people. And remember, the insurance companies don't provide 1 ounce of health care.
Right.
They simply take money, take a share of it as it goes through their hands, and pays the people who really provide health care, the doctors, the nurses, the hospitals, the other health care providers.
And I've discovered that the vast majority of health care providers, maybe a few years ago they didn't want it, but now they really want universal, oftentimes single payer, which is not happening now. Well, what about single payer? I mean, that would that never happen if, you know, once some sort of compromise things get, something gets through, or does this enable that to happen in the future?
Well, one of the arguments, the big argument of the insurance industry is that if we have a public option, it will ultimately become a single payer.
Right.
And I always say to them, well, that's only true if you guys do a terrible job at providing what you do. You know, obviously, at least from my personal point of view, you know, it, the only real rational approach to solving these problems is to provide essentially Medicare for every American.
Yeah. Well, that's not happening now.
There's no reason not to, except the interest of the health insurance industry that stands in the way.
Well,
which, by the way, the health insurance industry, we say that, we're talking about the health insurance, the investors in the health insurance industry, the CEOs, and the investors, the people who own these health insurance, it's Wall Street. I mean, it's the same gang that brought us this recession.
Well, that is certainly true, that's where the power is, and power seldom gives up without a fight, I've discovered. And
power never gives up anything without a struggle.
Well,
it never will.
That's true. Well, what can people do? I mean, it's very complicated right now. There's this thing called the exchange, which maybe you can just briefly explain what the exchange is, because I'm not sure I really understand it.
Well, the exchange is basically the creation of a marketplace that has requirements to participate, like no, you can't discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. You can't can't cut off people when they're sick. The kind of basic things of what health insurance are about. Those exchanges would happen on a state level, run by the federal government, but on a state level, so that in every state you can participate. And if you don't have an insurance provided at work, you can go to the exchange and find out what's best for you in terms of an insurance policy, all of them meeting clear criteria and being able to compare apples and apples. One of those choices would be a public health insurance plan that you get to choose if you want it, not if you don't want it. I mean, why that's not obviously good for everybody, I don't know. The other thing that you get is a subsidy if your income is appropriate level, so that the availability of insurance coverage is affordable. Now, it's very, very important that affordability be there, because in the end, you know, people don't care at all about the deficit or the spending when it comes to this bill. In the end, they care about what are they going to pay for health insurance, and are they going to be able to keep it if they need it. That's what they care about. That's how its success or failure will be measured.
So,
you ask what people can do about it.
Yes.
And you know, everyone in the next 2 months has to repeatedly contact their members of Congress and tell them they want to pass a strong health insurance reform bill that includes a public option. And there are no excuses going to be given. I mean, you need to be real clear if you're a listener to go talk to your member of Congress, your member of the Senate, and insist with passion, because you know what they worry about is passionate advocacy. They don't just people don't, in Congress don't just measure the quantity of people who think something; they measure and worry about its intensity.
Uh-huh.
So be passionate about what you want, and go see these people, go talk to them, and don't let them off the hook with a lot of policy gobbledygook. The real issue is: are you with the insurance companies? Or are you with us? Simple as that.
Pretty straightforward. Robert Kramer, thanks so much for being with us here on Portside.
Good to be with you, Bert.
All right. And it still could be a hard road ahead for health insurance, but you can do your part. Thanks for listening to another edition of Portside. I'm Bert Cohen.
score.